This is America's Sports Talk Show, Sports Byline USA. Here's Ron Barr.
I get a number of books across my desk, and they're written by athletes, and usually they fall into two categories, fluff and motivational. But I've got a book by R.A. Dickey, the knuckleballer for the New York Mets, that is anything but that. It's very honest, it's very open, and it's very frank. It's called Wherever I Wind Up, My Quest for Truth, Authenticity, and the Perfect Knuckleballer. And knuckleball. And in the book, he discusses the sexual abuse that he suffered as a child and his struggles with suicidal thoughts as an adult. 10-year veteran and pitcher, as I said, for the New York Mets. You know, R.A., when I get these books and I look through them, they don't leave me with anything. But your book certainly did as I looked through it and read some of the chapters of this book. How hard was this book for you to write?
Well, it started being very, very hard. I was laying down on an air mattress in the basement of a 2008 rental home in Tacoma, Washington, and started writing the book. And it just was so painful, I had to kind of put it down. And I left it down for a couple of years until I felt like I had the equipment and the vocabulary to be able to communicate what I wanted to communicate about my story. And that was really a story that ends up in redemption. But as you well know, to get to redemption, you have to walk through some pretty dark places. So that's where it begun for me.
What did you learn about yourself through this effort that maybe you did not know before you started doing it?
Oh, that's a great question. I learned that I had much more to offer the world than just being a major league pitcher, you know, for so long in my life. Because of the damage that is done when you're sexually abused, you kind of feel like you're broken and fractured and unlovable, so to speak. And I, you know, through a lot of therapy and a lot of cathartic experiences, including writing this book, I felt like I had a story to offer the world that might be able to help people that perhaps went through similar experiences of my own.
I think it's fair to say that you are a survivor. Would you agree with me?
I would agree.
Are you surprised that you survived? And when you look back upon it, what were the things that helped you survive?
Well, you know, early on when, as an 8-year-old boy, and of course, is, you know, the summer of 83, the chapter in the book about being an 8-year-old boy and being sexually abused, you start to come up with all these mechanisms for surviving. And more times than not, I would say most of the time, in fact, they're really unhealthy ways. They're to block them off, to stuff them in compartments and jam them back in the recesses of your mind and heart. And you really don't develop like you should as you grow. You're scared to do relationship. You're scared to trust people. And I poured myself into sports. That was where I found my escape, whether it was a football field, a basketball court, or a baseball diamond. I was always on some field or court somewhere trying to run from the truth. And I spent a lifetime running from the truth, and it cost me a lot. And it wasn't until probably a good 7 years ago that I really started to unpack the things that had made me unhealthy and try to become an authentic man.
One of the things that I was surprised by, and I think you should get a lot of credit for, is that you were scarred twice by abuse, one by a female babysitter and the other by a 17-year-old boy. And usually when that happens, people can't come to grips with it. First of all, they look in the mirror and maybe think that it was their fault. And usually there is a foundation, a family foundation, that could support them. You did not have that. And I'm just wondering how you kept yourself afloat to be able to deal with these two scarring events.
Well, I would say, you know, you're right on the money. You do feel like, and which is one of the reasons I never came forward with my abuse stories, is because in some way you do feel like it is your fault. And you feel like you're in the middle of something very wicked and very evil, yet you feel like you have contributed in some way to it. And that's such a deterrent for being open with it. And even if the people do love you and you know you're in a loving environment, it's still hard to bring something that dark to light. For me, you know, I've got to say, and this isn't a cliche for me, but I really feel like God's grace helped me through a lot of difficult times early on. And I certainly had people pour into me and love me well in a lot of different ways. I went to an all-boys school at Montgomery Bell Academy in Nashville, Tennessee, and I found a lot of structure and regiment there. That was a big proponent or component and kind of saving me. It got me out of the neighborhoods that I was in, and there were a lot of teachers and coaches who really cared for me deeply, and those types of things really helped to save me. Now, I didn't come forward with my abuse then, but it certainly felt good to be loved by somebody, certainly.
You know what I'm surprised about also, R.A., is the fact that you talk about it in the book, that you discuss about being at bars late at night with your mother as a five-year-old and then sleeping in abandoned houses as a teenager. Now, that is something that doesn't at least point to stability. So what was the issues there early in your life, and where did stability finally come into your life?
Well, early on in my life, you know, I was a child of a divorced couple, and we all, you know, I'm not alone in that. There are countless people who grew up in divorced families. I lived with my mom for quite some time, and she admittedly, you know, we have a fantastic relationship today, and she is a pillar of courage for me presently, but she had her own demons that she was fighting as far as alcohol goes, and so we would find ourselves late at night with her friends in bars and whatnot, and that was kind of my culture growing up. And then from there, when I moved in with my father when I was a teenager, it was trying to cultivate a relationship with him that really wasn't there, and it was just a lonely place. You know, it was really lonely, and I felt alone. And at least when I would find those abandoned houses, what I would do is I would look in the classifieds in the paper and find out the houses for rent near the school that I was going to, and I would kind of sneak into those homes, do a couple of drive-bys to make sure nobody was still living there. And usually there was a hide-a key somewhere under a flower pot or a mat, and I would go in there. And at least then it was a loneliness of my choosing. You know, it wasn't me going back home to a lonely environment. At least I chose that when I had some control over it. And that's part of the dysfunction too, I think, Ron.
One of the other things that I know is that communication is so important for a young person, particularly one that went through the traumas that you went through. Who was that person early in your life, R.A., that you finally were able to connect to?
You know, early in my life, I had an uncle named Ricky Bowers who was an athlete that I really looked up to and wanted to emulate. I think he was kind of my first window into sports. And you know, sports did a lot for me. It provided, you know, an oasis of sorts for me to kind of go to and drink from in order to feel invigorated that I had some value. It gave me a sense of identity, albeit, you know, an unhealthy identity. And he was really instrumental, more instrumental than he probably realized. And, you know, my mother was fantastic. I mean, she, even though she was struggling with her own demons and had to go to treatment, she came out the other side of that. And as we grew older and as I went through my own cathartic experiences and my own therapeutic experiences, we really rekindled a fantastic relationship. And so she has been instrumental in my wife presently. She knows the ugliest things about me and loves me despite them. And that's a special place to be.
I know you went to the University of Tennessee, certainly Peyton Manning and also Todd Helton, others that went to that university as well. I've known Peyton Manning since he was 2 years old, so that kind of dates me a little bit. But those athletes that you ran into, like Todd and like Peyton, tell me a little bit about whether they influenced your life and what you observed about them since they went on to become great athletes.
You know, they did impact my life, and neither of them would probably know it, simply because I felt the way I felt from being sexually abused and didn't want to get into relationship, especially with other guys. I would just really observe. I was really observant. And so the things I observed them doing, the way they prepared themselves, the discipline that they exhibited in their respective sports, you know, the commitment that each of them displayed, those things were all things that I paid attention to and wanted to emulate. And I felt like that really taught me a lot while I was at UT.
One of the things that you write about after being the number one draft choice of the Texas Rangers, you say everything was falling into place. My map to the majors laid out before me as precise as anything a cartographer could draw. But all of a sudden, that picture got ugly. Tell me about that picture.
Well, the picture was on the cover of a Baseball America, and it showed the Olympic starters all in a row. and I was one of the Olympic starters for the 1996 Olympic team. And I had just signed a major league contract, or agreed in principle to a major league contract with the Texas Rangers. Well, after the Olympic Games was over, I had to go take a physical. And the trainer for the team noticed on the cover of that Baseball America that my arm was bent at a funny angle and demanded that I get a physical taken, a very comprehensive physical. And when they did take that physical, the discovery was made eventually that I did not have the existence of an ulnar collateral ligament. What that ulnar collateral ligament is basically the Tommy John ligament, or the ligament that brings stability to that elbow joint. I just didn't have it. He had never seen anything like it before, and obviously that wasn't good news to the Rangers, and they pulled any offer that they had back. At the time, I was a first-round pick, and it agreed to close to $850,000 as a first-round pick, and they took that offer off the table, and it wasn't until the final hours that they eventually said, well, here's $75,000, take it or leave it. I prayed about it and decided that was what I wanted to do, and so I took their $75,000 and got on with my professional career.
We're talking with R.A. Dickey, pitcher for the New York Mets, a very wonderful book and story, and I hope that people will check this out. It's called Wherever I Wind Up, My Quest for Truth, Authenticity, and the Perfect Knuckleball. We'll continue this story as we continue across the country and around the world. We've got you on Sports Byline.